I'm going to get started. I'm going to do the syllabus when more people get here. We're going to be doing the Maharal. Some of you have a syllabus already because I had your emails. Those of you who didn't, I'm going to hand it out to you now. And at some point, I'll take your email. All the handouts and everything eventually will be up online, as will recordings of the class. The class is going to be very broad in the fact that it'll start with Ashkenaz in general of the 15th century, and it's going to go all the way up to the usages of the Maharal in the 20th century, which will include Tzvi Yehuda and Mechtav Meliyahu, and you know, any of the reasons that you might want to be, or put in there, the things that you do get from it. Okay, so let me get started. The thought of Ashkenaz. I mean, why does the Maharal seem so unique? So in the historical work of Heinrich Gretz, he dismissed all of Ashkenaz as being non-philosophic, obscurantist. Jacob Katz, in his historical writings, did this in a much more subtle fashion and basically said that they were exclusivist, they were not concerned with universals. But starting in the 1950s, Chaim Hillel Ben Sasson, the father of the one that occasionally comes here to teach, had a series of articles showing that rationalism was all over Central and Eastern Europe. And he wrote a book called Hagut Vahanhaga, Thought and Society, showing this. He shows that Jews were engaged in polemics with Christians. They were well-read. They tried to save their congregants from converting to Christianity. And they developed a useful philosophy. In the 1970s, Ephraim Kupfer, K-U-P-F-E-R, wrote a series of articles showing serious rationalism within Ashkenaz. He found all these manuscripts of 14th century commentaries on the Mor Nebuchim, 14th century Jewish Averroists. He points out how Yom Tov Lippmann Milhausen was a rationalist and a Maimonidean in the 15th century. By the 1990s, people already referred to Kupfer as the Kupfer thesis, that Ashkenaz was just as rational as any other country. But they limited it. And the two people who did the best job of that was Otto Dov Kulka, K-U-L-K-A, and Ephraim Talmage. They showed that the elite in Prague were open to philosophy and rationalism from the 13th, 14th, 15th century onward. Others will show there was a small circle in 14th, 15th century Lita. But that says nothing about Lublin or any other part of Eastern Europe. Meaning Prague is going to be unique. Yaakov Elbaum will put out a book called Pitzichut Histeigrut, Openness and Withdrawal, showing the tensions within Polish 16th century culture, showing that in some cities, some elements, some batei midrashot were opened, others were not. But Yaakov Elbaum has two points that he made. One, everyone in Poland blurs the lines between philosophy, Kabbalah, midrash, and all other types of thought. Meaning you just basically get there and you're doing philosophy, Kabbalah, midrash, halacha as one. Two, they emphasize Talmud Torah over philosophy. Don't confuse them with the Spaniards or the Italians. They even within their philosophies, they make the Talmud Torah centered, as the Maharal will. The most recent formulation of this is David Ruderman in the Encyclopedia of the Renaissance, points out how Prague and Krakow had rational philosophic elements. Prague, because it's Central European, it was in Bohemia, hence our phrase, you're a Bohemian, meaning the kingdom was a much more open kingdom. Krakow, because the princess of Krakow was Italian, and she basically brought in Renaissance Italian culture into Krakow. Says nothing about Lublin, let alone the Ukraine. Okay. I think enough people are here for me to go over the syllabus. Who did not get, and then I'll continue with the historic part. Who didn't get one? Okay. There's one. Put that back. I only have, I think, the 7 copies. Pass this back because I sent it. What? No, it's 7 pages. Pass this back. I will have more copies next time, or they will be available online, but there you go for. Okay. You can look on with someone for the interim. This is, well, yeah, I did already.
Tomorrow?
Yeah. But that's okay. Of course, we'll cover the thought of Yehuda Lowell of Prague through extensive readings in his writings. Topics covered will be his associative method, reasons for the commandments, creation, divine attributes, miracles, determinism, anthropology, ethical system, messianism. We'll discuss the relationship of his thought to philosophy, Kabbalah, and Renaissance thoughts. And we can conclude with his influence on the writings of 18th and 19th century thoughts. You can almost always reach me by email. There'll be a paper and a final. You're responsible for the handouts given in class. Be sure to receive copies. The selections labeled readings are mandatory for the final. They also have a bold print number by them. Those listed as suggested are optional. We'll adjust the readings as needed based on class discussion. Please have available a set of Maharal's writings. You can have any edition. There is the basic edition in 14 volumes that came out originally called the Kol Kitvei. There is a fancier set that was then put out in England. There is then the new Israeli versions from the Merkaz world. And now there is someone who is taking each volume of the Maharal and putting them out in 3 or 4 footnotes, 3 or 4 volumes with dense footnotes. That is not necessary at all. I mean, basically that's a computer-generated book in which he would take given volumes, not with any wisdom. He will just give you every parallel citation to the Maharal on the page in the bottom. So instead, you'd be better off buying a set of Maharal.
Whole set on reference?
Whole set on reference. There's a whole set in the base manager. There's a whole set lots of places. Okay? For finding topics in the Maharal, there's a small two volumes in one by Avram Kariv called Kitvei Maharal Mi Prague Mivchar. It's a useful topical arrangement, but it usually leaves out where he got it from. It's easier to solve in the computer age, but originally that was a major drawback. The DBS CD-ROM has Maharal, and with Suriel, formerly of Shalavim, has Otsrat Maharal, Maftechot, and Nyanim, which is not just a word index, but it actually is, that you can see, it's just like notes to himself, so it's conceptually arranged. That's on reference in the library. Okay, background. Today's class and into the next class is all backgrounds. First we deal with Ashkenaz. All of that is background. You don't have to read it. Then we go into Italy. Then we go into Poland. I'm spending the time in Ashkenaz and Italy because Maharal's reading list should be known to you. Maharal he was reading materials from the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries that are not usually learned anymore. Then Poland, the first recorded reading is Chaim Hillel ben Sasson's Hagut v'Hanhagah, and Yaakov Elman's Petichut v'Histagrut. They are in Hebrew, they are not easy reads. Get them read by the final. Take notes on them. You know, pick on the carbon in the class who reads Hebrew well, who has to summarize them for you. Whatever it means, you got to get through them. That's the only real Hebrew reading. We will then do Maharal's brother, Chaim ben Bezalel, Sefer HaChaim, his older and more famous brother, so let you know under whose shadow he worked. And we're going to be doing possibly some of Yitzhak Chayutz, the one who actually got the major pulpit in Prague, to know what the actual thought was of the time, what he was competing with, or who his competitor was. Then we can get started on the Maharal himself, his life, and his, the way he wrote and his educational theory. And then reading number 3 is on page 3, Aaron Kleinberger's The Educational Theory of Maharal, of which chapter 9 is available in English. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 don't contain that much, but the important chapter, chapter 9, is in English. Then, starting the philosophy of Maharal, 4 and 5, Nahar versus Shatz. That'll be the opening setup. Then, 6 and 7, the Renaissance philosophers that are read by Maharal, meaning Ficino, and the function of Brian Vickers' article, The Function of Analogy in the Occult, meaning when Maharal says this equals this equals this equals this, that was a that was the way people wrote at that time. So enter into that. I will be giving you out an article that I wrote forthcoming that compares the two. Next page. This is going to go very quickly. We're going to be up to page number 3 in no time. The class really gets started on Unit 4 with mitzvot in Maharal. I will give you a handout package of some readings by Alan Senior, Avi Wolfish, and Martin Buber. That will be a serious unit that will go for a month. So proportionally, Units 1 through 3 we're doing quickly in 2 weeks. Mitzvot in Maharal is a major focus. You couldn't tell it from here, but there's nothing been written on the topic. We're then going to go into Torah within Maharal, then the idea of hiddenness. Then we're going to, now that you've read enough of Maharal, we'll approach number 7, is the irrationalist or Kabbalist, medieval Renaissance. Then we turn to Netivot Olam, his theory of the human being. Then we turn to his views of history and determinism, and we read Rivka Schatz's article. Next page. Then we deal with how he approached texts and the polemics he had with Christians. And you'll be reading Yaakov Elbaum's article in English on Maharal and Agadita. And there's an interesting website of somebody who does Mishnah according to the method of the Maharal that some of you might take a liking to. Then we're now at the last third of the course. We then do the fellow travelers of the Ramah and the Lavush and others. We'll do some selections of why, of what his contemporaries thought. There then was 130 years in which nobody read the Maharal. Maharal gets reprinted in the 18th century and is then used by Chassidut. So I'm going to give you some handouts on how Chassidut used Maharal. Then we are going to be handouts of how Polish Chassidut used Maharal and how Lithuania, how Litvaks used Maharal. But then we're going to then spend more of the time on the last unit, number 16, the Rav Huttner, the Rav Desper, the Rav Tzvi Yehuda, the Heschel, and the Shmuel Alexandrov. How did he come in as a major player in first to mid-half of the 20th century? Why did everyone turn back to the Maharal? What was the attraction? I find people want to spend more time on that one. Go light on the Chassidut, because it's not a course in Chassidut. Get down to the 20th century and how he's used today. Questions on that? The lectures will be on yutorah.org, as will the articles will all be on e-reserve in the library when they get their acts together and find out where they are. There is a box with hard copy that it's their responsibility to upload, and I'll be giving out selected texts. I'm working from the 14 volume called Kitveh. And like I said, I can't read through 20 parakim in class. I'm going to be picking selected pages and parakim to do in class, but I'll be discussing things that will go beyond the bounds of the page that I do in class. Okay? Yes?
When you're doing the reading in class, you'll give us
photocopies? I will give you photocopies. They've been actually made already. But the point is, if I'm doing, for example, with mitzvot, we're going to get started on Haggadah Shal Pesach. You'll have lots to say for Pesach from this course. So I'll have selected paragraphs, even though I'm going to tell you read the rest of the chapters in Beret Hashem to fill out the rest of the idea. Okay? Good. Back to where I last left you, Ashkenaz. We're talking about 14th, 15th century Ashkenaz in Prague studying philosophy. We actually have manuscripts from Aristotle and Averroes in Hebrew. More interestingly, from that point on, there is going to be a Maimonidean turn within Prague. There'll be hymns written based on philosophy. The most famous of which will be many of our versions of Yigdal and Ani Maamin, of which the Maharil came out against them, because many Jews thought all you need to do to be a good Jew was to sing Yigdal as a catechism, to sing the 30 Ani Maamins and not do anything else. We only know his side of the story. He's claiming that they just basically thought Judaism is a religion of faith, of belief, and therefore if you sing the Ani Maamins, you're a good Jew. There's definitely some acculturation to 15th century Christian patterns going on, but we don't have what the other side thought to play it out. We have a book, Sefer Nitzachon, which is a polemical work by Rav Yom Tov Milhausen, which deals with defending of faith within 15th century Ashkenaz, and he brings together Kabbalah and philosophy. And already Yom Tov Milhausen in Sefer Nitzachon is going to say that Ashkenaz and Rambam are in agreement, meaning that Shir HaKavod, Anim Zmirot, that describes the male kavod of the divine, God's body, Ashkenaz theology, assume that you have an Elot to Elot, cause of causes of the unknown divine, then you have a God's manifestation as a kavod, and below that you have some sort of visible kiseh hakavod that we sing to in Amim Zmirot. And rather than that being the opposite of the Rambam, 15th century Ashkenaz took that as being in harmony with the Rambam. So already before we get to the Maharal, meaning almost anything in Kabbalah and anything in philosophy can be harmonized. And I'm giving you this long background because it's important to know where the Maharal is coming from. And Yom Tov Milhausen says that when you pray, take a topic I do know about, he says you should be thinking about the Elot HaElot, which is the same as thinking about the divine within the Rambam as the divine essence. And don't think about the Kisei HaKavod, which is only Torah Pe'ula, attributes of action. They make everything work out in their thinking. There was a question at some point? Yeah.
The Ashkenaz around this time is based in Kabbalah?
Ashkenaz at this point is based in Prague, in the city of Prague, on the coming to be of philosophy and Kabbalah. An author that we have living in Prague is Avigdor Kara. Some of you may have come across him in your Bible classes. And Rav Avigdor Kara, besides writing on the Bible, also wrote popular poems about God. And in these poems, they're fascinating to read. You can read more in the Talmudge article. He'll talk about Jew, Christian, Jethro, Bilam, all of us worship one God. There is one true God. God is one. God is unique. We all accept creation ex nihilo. We all accept God as nobody. And this mystery of the faith was revealed to the Jews. I mean, songs about philosophy. Avigdor Kara was also known for being involved with the Protestants within that time and being on good terms with them. And within the Jewish literature, they credit the rise of Unitarianism to Avigdor Kara, meaning within the legends the Polish Jews tell, the Unitarian Church got started through Avigdor Kara. Let me backtrack with that. Bohemia of 15th and 16th century was an open society. The Habsburg monarchy allowed religious freedom. Hence, every Christian heretical sect that denied the Trinity, denied Catholicism, was given free rein, as were every magician and every other belief, hence our term Bohemians. And the in religion that was coming to be in the Bohemia of Maharal and of Avigdor Kara was a Christianity that gave up Trinitarianism, calling itself the Unitarians. Some of you may have taken Western Civ and learned about the Hussite Rebellion, which was going on in Bohemia against the Catholic Church, against the Trinity. And the Habsburg dynasty, certainly at the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century, put up with much of it. And as I said, Jewish myth credits Avigdor Kara with helping to create Unitarianism. On the other hand, Avigdor Kara's own writings talk about how both Jews and Christians accept God's unity, and he's clearly pointing to Christians in his time being Unitarians. That's the background you need for Ashkenaz. Let's now move to Italy, because this is even more unknown to you. Okay, in Italy you're going to have humanism, Platonism, Kabbalah, and Hermeticism in the 15th and early 16th century. Maharal will have read much of it. So let's deal with the humanism first. An important humanist is Rav Avadya Soferno, rabbi in Bologna, wrote his book Or Amim, The Light of the Nations, dedicated to the King of England, in which he presents a view that God is universally available to all. We are all Tzelem Elohim from Adam. And surprisingly, Sepharno even says, I'm Nivchar, when we're the chosen people. He just means because we are actually doing God's word, but everybody could be following it if they want to. We're just stricter in it. Yeah, everyone, that's right. Everyone can be following the correct what God wants from you. No, because that's our. He's not getting involved in that question. It's a universal philosophy. Late 15th, early 16th century Jews were universal, and that's part of why we don't learn them as much anymore. Sepharno's humanism will deal with emotions, imagination, a lot of the human elements of life, unlike the medievals, which were much more intellectual, concerned with developing your intellect. This is still Sepharno. Yeah, this is Aravadya Sepharno. And Maharal will have a set of Sepharno. He will be a reader of it. So bear that in mind as you're going along. I mean, as much as people who have signed up for this course came because it's called Maharal, many people walk out of the course becoming Sepharno readers because you never understood where he fit in or what role he played. Okay? It's giving you a Renaissance universal approach. Renaissance Italy also has the humanism of critical texts. Already, Don Isaac Abarbanel and Azaria de Rossi are quoting Roman histories and church fathers in order to understand rabbinic literature. Both of them are already accepting books outside of the Jewish canon. Both of them are trying to understand the meaning of the Bible in a somewhat historic, realist approach, unlike medieval philosophers and Kabbalists who looked for deep sodot. On this account, Maharal is going to reject this element of humanism. There will also be Averroism, which is a continuation of the medieval approach of Aristotle as a naturalist without any supernatural. Figures in Italy that were followed this trend was Yehuda Messer Leon and Rev Eliyahu Del Medigo, who both believed philosophy was philosophy. Maharal is going to reject this trend. Let me go on. Yehuda Messer Leon the Averroist has a Christian student, Pico Mirandella, who is going to be part of a circle of Christian intellectuals in Florence, turning back to Plato and the wisdom of the ancients. Pico is going to study under Rabbi Yehuda Messer Leon the ancient wisdom of the Hebrews. Pico is also going to be influenced by a more famous Florence philosopher, Marcello Ficino, F-I-C-I-N-O, who's going to turn Renaissance thought away from Aristotle and toward Plato. They are going to understand Plato not like the medievals did, or not like you do in your masterpieces of Western Civ here, by reading The Republic, in which Plato is about political philosophy and an ideal state. They will read Plato as being a spiritual being drawn forth in Eros toward the divine. outside the terrestrial world. Our term platonic love comes from the circle. You have a platonic love toward another person, and this helps draw you forward. Pico, in turn, as much as Pico learned from a Jewish teacher, Pico will have a Jewish student, Rav Yonatan Alamano. Now, Alamano will not just have read Ficino. Alamano will also be reading much of the magic of the Renaissance and introduce into Jewish language the idea of hermeticism, that when you do a mitzvah, you bring down ruchaniyut. You bring down these spiritual qualities from up above into yourself when you do it. To come full circle, Yehuda Meselion's son, David ben Yehuda Meselion, becomes a Platonist and also studies in Florence. Not the purpose of this course, but know that Rav Moshe Cordovero in Svat is aware of a lot of this Italian material. I'll give you a few more names to make sure you're sufficiently confused at this point. Avraham Dibalmas will be a professor of philosophy and of medicine. Italian universities were open to Jews. And Dibalmas is going to be a doctor, a Averroist, and Kabbalist. And he's going to write a fascinating little book called Igeret Asirit, showing everything in Judaism as a power of ten, in which philosophy and Kabbalah come together. Now, Kabbalah for Italians, where for Ashkenaz, Kabbalah meant the theory of the Kavod, the tension between the Elot to Elot and the theory of the Kavod and how many Kavods there are in the angelic realms around the Kavod. In Italy, Kabbalah meant the spiritual relationship you have with the divine. Kabbalah meant the tenfold structure to the universe. And Kabbalah meant bringing down ruchaniyut when you do a mitzvah. Meaning they saw Kabbalah as being mystical, as being love of the divine, a lot of the way we use the word mysticism in English now. But in the beginning of the 16th century, the Gerer Svarad, those Jews who moved from Spain to Italy, are going to bring their Kabbalah with them, and they're going to have the Zohar published in the 1560s, bringing Spanish Kabbalah to Italy. And there'll be two figures, Rabbi Yehuda Chayat and Rabbi Yosef Ibn Shraga, who are now teaching Spanish Kabbalah within Italy. So unlike the Kabbalah of David ben Yehuda Meselion, that assumes all Kabbalah is atzmut, and it's all talking about God's oneness, and we all have to connect with God's oneness in some sort of Rabkuk sort of way, the Spaniards are going to come in and teach everyone about Sfirot, and about the Zohar, and about how to correctly formulate everything, and they're going to have those books published.
This is all pre-Mara.
Contemporary. Contemporary. 1560s. Yehuda Chayat shows up there in 1492. But Zohar doesn't get published until the 1560s.
What year is
Mara? 1520s to 1609. Okay? I'm giving you all the building blocks in advance that you'll need as we go on. Any name that I mention here, believe it or not, will come up later in the course. And that's why this is so important, is that's why the Maharal seems so Yotzei Dofen to us in the Beit Midrash, because if you go from the Rambam straight to Chassidut and nothing in between, the Maharal is part of this Renaissance world and a whole shelf of Svarim that people don't usually use. So like I said, as much as you'll come out being able to learn Maharal, you'll come out with a greater appreciation for the Svarno and others as useful Svarim. What am I up to? Maharal, okay, will also quote, read non-Jews. We don't know what he's reading. In the Be'er HaGolah, Maharal writes he's not going to quote non-Jews because that's not the way of the Beit Midrash. When Maharal quotes philosophy and Kabbalah, you've got to peg him down. What is he really referring to? Don't think you know in advance, because usually he's referring to one of these Renaissance books. Maharal, as someone who lived in Posen and Prague, would have been able to speak German and Czech. He had lived in both countries. The question is, how much Italian did he know and how much Latin did he know? The fact that he's reading Svarim, reading secular books, is he reading them in German? Is he reading them in Italian? Or is he even reading them in Hebrew translation? It's a very hard thing to figure out. And whatever he read, knows that these were the early days of printing. Do not assume that anything that he read is available in any library in America. That's important to bear in mind also, that a lot of his early first printings were only printed once. They're not the editions we know of anything. Now, Moshe Idel has three articles on the world of Italy, the particularism and universalism in the Kabbalah, the magical and Neoplatonic interpretations of the Kabbalah, and major currents in Italian Kabbalah. I'm not assigning you to read them. Idel does not establish any exact history to all these books. But Idel served as a corrective because no book on Jewish history and no book on Kabbalah dealt with any of these Italians, because none of these Italians dealt with Sirot. Now I can move to country number three, Poland. First of all, people were going back and forth between Poland and Italy all the time. The yeshivot in the beginning of the 16th century were in Italy. Only in the course of the 16th century do people move, meaning people were going, if you were an Ashkenazi Jew living in Lublin, you would likely send your kids to study with someone like Rav Yehuda Mintz in Italy. And only later did Poland develop in the 16th century the Beit Midrash of the Marshal and the Ramah. Even figures like the Ramah of Moshe Isserles, his brother lived in Italy. And most of the people asking questions to the Ramah are not in Prague, but living in Italy. So the connections go back and forth. It was common to spend a year in yeshiva in Italy. If you lived in 1620s Poland, you were likely to have spent a year in yeshiva in Italy. So it also makes it more complex how much Italian, how much Latin did they pick up while they were there? What did they bring back? Who are the connections? And everybody, his family is connected to Italy because that's where the money was to be made. So even if you lived in Prague or Krakow, you had connections. Krakow, as I told you, as a whole, was a Renaissance Italian city because the princess of Krakow was Italian. So she sets it up not looking to German culture, but looking to Italian culture. But let's now deal with Poland itself. Okay, listen closely on this because you might have never thought on these terms. Traditional Ashkenaz culture was an oral culture. Halacha was halacha kibasrai, following the last generation. Psak was oral. Come the rise of the printing press, we have a switch from oral to written culture. And that's going on in the lifetime of the Maharal. And we have three major changes. Let me get to the three changes and I'll take questions. One, we now have a printed Gemara with Rashi and Tosfos. And that was a decision of the Italian printers to put all whichever Tosfot they wanted to on the page. In Spain, for example, in the Academy of Yitzchak Confitone that created Rav Yaakov Beirav and created Rav Yosef Karo, the Mechaber, you learned Rashi and the Ramban. And if not the Ramban, you learned the Ran. You didn't learn Tosfot. Beit Yosef did not grow up learning Tosfot. You learned Tosfot through the Ramban, Rashba, Ran. But now you have a printed page being printed in Italy that has Rashi Tosfot on the page. That one has changed the canon. And it's going to lead to the creation not of commentaries anymore, but super commentaries. So this is now going to be the start of writing, not on Chumash, but commentaries on Rashi. So right now, currently at the beginning of the 21st century, we're up to about 300 commentaries on Rashi, super commentaries on Rashi. This is the start, so we're going to have, among other figures, Maharal is going to write the Gur Aryeh on Rashi. The psychology of a super commentary already means you have a printed text, and which already has a canonical status that you are writing. You are writing on it. You're going to also have now the way you comment on the Gemara. Same part of this. In the past, if you wanted to write on the Gemara, you either wrote directly on the Gemara or you summarized the people who came beforehand. Now we are going to have a new method of learning called Chiluk, in which you are going to try to be medayek in Rashi and Tosfot. The most famous names for that are the Marshal, the Marshal. Meaning, why did Rashi say this? Why did Tosfos say that? And now you have the activity of going into the Beit Midrash is learning Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot without anything else. And now writing commentaries on Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot as a set. What has dropped out of the equation? The entire Ashkenaz tradition of everything from the Mordechai to the Maharil to everything else has disappeared. And since Poland won't have it, the world of the Ramban, Rashba, Ran, till it started to get republished in the 18th century and then got really published in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and you're learning something brand new that wasn't out there. The Maharal is going to be against Gemara Rashi Tosfot. and be in favor of learning straight Mishnah and Gemara, saying that people are spending their time turning Tosfot into an Ikar when Gemara is the Ikar. Maharal is going to be against Chiluk, but Maharal will be in favor of super commentary on Rashi. Okay? That's point number one. Point number two, the printing press will create codification. The 15th century work, the Tour, with the commentary of the Beit Yosef, and then the abridgments of the Mechaber Ramah, are going to be brand new. The Maharal is going to be against codification and say that every postdoc has to derive for himself. But more importantly, the brother, Rav Chaim ben Bezalel, will write of Akuach Mayim Chaim, he will write a book against codification. And his brother is going to be famous, the Maharal's brother, Chaim ben Bezalel, for being against codification, for telling people not to use Beit Yosef or Mechaber Ramah, but instead every posek has to be able to go back to the Gemara himself. And two, you're ignoring the oral Ashkenaz culture that went through the Rush to the Mordechai, to the Mahariel, up to Rav Chaim ben Bezalel. You are doing away with the Mesora, you are doing away with the orality of it, you are doing away with the Derech Psika, you are doing away with Halacha Kibasrai. So that's a fascinating book to read, as is the Yom Shel Shlomo, who also in his introduction to various Masechtos has also a diatribe against codification, that halacha has to remain oral, and it's after the Gemara there should be no fixed books anymore. Know that the Maharal is caught up in this, based on his brother, of the need to go back to primary works. Point number three. In 1550s, in both Posen and Prague, there's going to be a minor Maimonidean controversy. But as Elchanan Reiner in an article points out, it's not really a Maimonidean controversy, because if you look at the books that are being condemned, it includes the Zohar, Rabbeinu Bachya al Torah, the Rabban, the Rashba, the Ran, the Namuke Yosef. What's really being condemned? It's being condemned is the rise of printed books that come from outside your culture. Meaning the 1550s, there'll be a tension within Posen and Prague. Do we continue to only rely on the oral culture and the manuscripts from Ashkenaz? Meaning Ashkenaz Kabbalah, Ashkenaz philosophy of Yom Tov Milhausen and of Avigdor Kara? Or do we now allow in the entire Spanish Beit Midrash of Svarim in Halacha, in Parshanut, in philosophy, in Kabbalah? Because that completely changes what learning in the Beit Midrash is about. Is it about getting the Masorah from Rav Avigdor Kara and Rav Yom Tov Milhausen and the Maharil? Or is it now, no, you go out and buy a set of books and it's now Mipi Svarim and not Mipi Sofrim? Or is the Derech Halimut also about the community and not about you being able to bring in things about from outside the community? Okay? Know that the Maharal generally does not quote these newly printed books, which is also going to send you into a quandary because his mindset is in a different place than yours is. Because eventually, as you know, Chiluk will win out as the way to learn rather than going back to the Gemara directly. Now, you know, certainly the Maharal saying you have to go back and learn Gemara without Tosfot did not win out. Number two, know that not only did the Mechaber win out, but the world of the Magen Avraham, the Shach Tazma, won out and transformed Polish Jewry into almost entirely learning super commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, and codification won out over Poland against the Maharal. And number three, the fact that we keep adding Svarim to the Beit Midrash keeps getting bigger and bigger about what we put there. It means the actual Ashkenaz tradition has been lost. Okay? I take any questions on that. Good. So Maharal is at the cusp point in which this is going on in his lifetime, and he's sticking up for the old, not for the new.
So can you explain to us what was the movement against bringing in Asset Books? Was it just like a personal?
The answer is no. I think there's many separate factors, and you read through the introduction of the Yom Shel Shlomo and the Kuach Mayim Chayim, you read through both of them and you're going to get a list of things. Torah Shebaal Peh should remain Baal Peh. Two, you reject the Ashkenaz Masorah. Three, this is too many outside Svarim that are too philosophic. Four, you are confusing secondary sources with primary sources.
The rabbis will lose their power.
The power of a rabbi has to be matabiel, to be matahar sheretz, and you have to learn how to do kuf nun z'amim. You can't, once you have codification, you can't do this. I mean, you can go, if you want places to go, and I would recommend going to the Encyclopedia Judaica, the article called Codification. Menachem Alon wrote a very nice article. Also, Rav Tsair of Chernovitz in his Toldot HaPoskim has a very nice chapter on this era dealing with the issues. Elchanan Reiner has an article on it. And I think Moshe Halbertal is working on an article on this transition. Okay. Good. Other rabbis that lived in the same time as the Maharal that you should know about, and we will come back to them after we do the Maharal, because none of them are as good reads as the Maharal. One, Rav Yaffa the Lavush, who wrote a commentary on halacha, philosophy, Kabbalah, and astrology, all as one single Shulchan Aruch. The first volumes are halacha as we know it based on the Torah. The fifth volume is an Averroistic commentary on the Mor Nevuchim. The sixth volume is a commentary on Kabbalah. And the seventh volume is on astrology. And he thought that was the Torah, having to know all seven parts. Meaning, knowing everything that's in the Torah plus philosophy, Kabbalah, and astrology. The Lavush did very well in its time, better than the Beit Yosef and the Mechaber Ramah. So in the time of Ashka, meaning someone in the time of the Maharal, if you're going to must use codification, the Lavush will preserve Minhag Ashkenaz, Minhag Rhineland, Minhag Tsarfat, Minhag Poland, in a way that the later works did not. But he also did, like I said, philosophy, Kabbalah, and astrology. Two, Rav Moshe Isserles, who besides being the Mechaber, wrote Torah HaOlah, which explains the symbolism of the Karbanot as bringing down Ruchaniyot. Three, Rav Eliezer Ashkenazi, who was rabbi in Poland, in Posen, Now, Eliezer Ashkenazi is an interesting person. He studied under Rabbi Yosef Taitzak in Andreapol, in Greece, Asia Minor. And came with a full Spanish philosophic training. He then became rabbi in Cairo, and then eventually becomes pulpit rabbi in Posen. He will get up and denounce Maharal from the pulpit as being against the Torah. So that's why I'm just setting him up now. Posen. Same town in eastern Germany as the Maharal was. But he got up from the pulpit and denounced Maharal as having the wrong ideas of God, as the Rambam taught us, and therefore being against the Torah. You need to know that now, because when we get to it occasionally, I mean, Maharal will mention it. You know, there is such a person who got up from the pulpit, and so they go back and forth with each other. Meaning, Eliezer Ashkenazi defending the Maimonidean position, the Maharal rejecting it. You have Rav Aaron Land and his son-in-law, Rav Yosef Ashkenazi, not to be confused with Eliezer Ashkenazi. Aaron Land and Yosef Ashkenazi, also Rabbanim and Posen, they're the ones who got up and said it's forbidden to read any of these new printed books. Forbidden to read. We stick to our Ashkenazi tradition. Okay. Now let's deal with the Maharal's life. We'll get down to Machshava, I trust you. This is just background. Okay, the Maharal, Rav Yehuda Lowell, was born someplace in the early 16th century, probably around 1520 or 1522, 1525, we don't know for certain. Already in the 18th century, in the beginning of the 18th century, there were stories about the Maharal. The Maharal became a legendary figure, and many of the stories told about others were transferred to Maharal. Maharal's older brother, Rav Chaim ben Bezalel, in his writings, says that his father, Rav Bezalel, took Reb Chaim to study with the Svardim so that he would know Chumash and Diktuk properly, unlike the Ashkenazim. We do not know, meaning the Maharal's brother writes that he was taken, meaning the brother, was taken to study with the Svardim so that he would know Chumash and Diktuk properly. We do not know if the father took Maharal also. Maharal never talks about his childhood education. But we do know that his brother says that his father made sure to get a Svardi teacher so that he knows proper Hebrew. But that is going to be an important point in the Maharal's writings, the importance of proper Chumash, proper Hebrew, proper Diktuk, proper back to the text. Yes?
How much older?
We don't know, since we don't know when year Maharal was born, we can't. More than a decade, which means there was enough changing circumstances that you can't guarantee anything. But clearly he's coming from a household that values knowing text properly and knowing Diktuk. Okay? In 1559, Rav Yehuda Lowell, the Maharal, I'm going to continue to refer to him as Maharal, unless you really want me to call him Rav Yehuda Lowell through the course. Maharal was rabbi in Nicholsburg. And in 1559, he's already trying to put his educational theories into practice. We'll talk much more about his educational theories, about the need to study Mishnah more than Gemara, the need to study, when you do study for Gemara, not to spend all your time doing Tosfot, the need to know Chumash with Dikduk, and then not to do any Pilpul whatsoever. In Nicholsburg, Maharal was already fighting with his congregants because he believed that a rabbi should be in charge, not them. He did not do well at his board meetings. We have a lot of the records. He also gets up in Nicholsburg already and condemns the drinking of Stam Yenim. Know that Italian, Northern Italian congregants, as well as the congregants in Krakow, Prague, Nicholsburg, and many other cities, drank Stam Yenim. There's a very backwards Mora Heter B'Shach Vatchach Malame Tzchut Tshuva of the Ramah of finding a way to permit it. I mean, not that he outright permits it, but this is real backwards, what can I do? Maharal, on the other hand, gets up from the pulpit, unlike all his other contemporary rabbis, and condemns it. Did not do wonders between him and the Balabatim. Let me just finish. Also in Poland at the time, there was mixed dancing. Maharal gets up from the pulpit and condemns it. I mean, Maharal left us his sermons. What?
Mixed dancing,
you know, going out dancing, men and women.
Oh, okay, not just black
folk. No, we're talking, like, think of some peasants, you know, 15th century, you know, we drink and we dance type of. And he got up and condemned it. Also, there was a book practice called the Bunding practice, in which engaged couples were brought by their parents to make out to see if they were compatible with each other, with the parents' permission once they were engaged. Maharal gets up and condemns that also. I mean, he's very proud of these sermons. I mean, that's why we have them. He was active in the 1573 Synod, a German Jewry. Ashkenaz Jewry at this point was organized in regular meeting of synods to deal with their political issues. The big rabbi for that synod was the brother, Chaim and Mesalel, but Maharal attended. In 1573, Maharal moves to Prague, paid for by one of his patrons, Hasidim, people who really likes his thought, Mordechai Meisel, a wealthy businessman who likes Maharal. Maharal will busy himself with many things, and was actually through the 16th, 17th, 18th century, Maharal was remembered most for being involved in the Chevra Kedisha, for being involved in a lot of mitzvah activities, being involved in kashrut, getting involved with which birds are kosher, which are not. So a lot of these discussions about which European birds have a Masorah, Maharal comes up. And Maharal's commentary on Yeridea, which is only about 30 pages, was one of the first things they reprinted in the 18th century, because that's where all this great stuff, you know, just like which birds are kosher. I mean, very brass tacks, very hands-on. Peacocks are kosher. This is, you know, giving you charts of birds, you know, not Chidushei Torah. In 1573, the rabbi of Prague dies. Maharal tries out for the job. He gets up at his prabha, he gets up at his interview to be a rabbi of Prague, And he actually published his sermon that he gave. And he gets up condemning them for drinking Stam Yedam. He gets up there for condemning them, everything they do wrong. Needless to say, he didn't get the job. He did not get the job. But he's proud of the sermon, and he publishes it nevertheless. And you just, as reading it with now more than 400 years hindsight, you just get a good smile, saying that's not what you go for your rabbinic interview, getting up condemning the practices of your congregation. So instead, Rav Yitzhak Chayat, a rabbi who trained in Italy, gets the job. And Yitzhak Chayat was a very major rabbinic figure in his time, running the major congregation in Prague. Yitzhak Chayat wrote a parish on Yeredeia and a parish in Hilchot Pesach, which are quoted by the Shach. But what's fascinating about these perushim, they were written in Italian rhyme form.
What?
On Hilchot Pesach and on Yeredeia, Kashrut issues. They're in Italian rhyme form with a commentary. I mean, he wrote a poem about the halachot, and then he wrote his own commentary on it. Yitzhak Chayat. And his introductions, he talks about how all Judaism works like a symphony with lots of this great Italian musical imagery. So he's the one who got the job rather than the Maharal. Yes. Chayas. However you want to spell Chayas, he spelled it in C-H-A-J-E-S. When he had to write in documents, Chayas in Hebrew is Ches Yud Vav Saf. What? But if you look in an academic library in the catalog, it's under Chayat, even though he never pronounced it that way, I can guarantee it. Yes. But you have to be, once again, you have to be willing to read Yeredeia in poem form with all sorts of musical references. Right? It's awesome, but that just shows you the world the Maharal is part of. So from 1584 to 1587, Maharal is rabbi in Posen. In 1587, he moves back to Prague and gets his own cloys, his own little Beit Midrash with a synagogue sponsored by Rav Mordechai Meisel again. In 1589, according to Maharal's student David Ganz, Maharal meets with the Emperor Rudolf II, and they talk about contemporary issues. We don't have a record of what they talked about. We assume they talked about, among other things, Copernicus, astronomy, the New Age, Platonism, the changing religious issues of the time.
What was he king of?
The Habsburg Empire in Bohemia. David Ganz, the student, and Rav Yitzhak Katz, a son-in-law of Maharal, says he actually discussed Nistarot with the emperor. Rudolf II, this very tolerant cosmopolitan emperor, dies in 1611. Maharal dies in 1609, 2 years before the emperor dies. And that's important because the Maharal lived his entire life in this Unitarian Renaissance city. Know that in 1611, as soon as this emperor died, the Catholic Church comes marching in to Prague to take over and restore the truth, to do away with all the heresy that's going on. And then 3 years later, you have the famous defenestration of Prague, when the citizens throw two people out of the window in order to protest against the clampdowns on intellectual freedom, among other things, political freedom also. Back to Maharal. In 1590s, Maharal is imposing again. And in 1599, they install him as rabbi in the synagogue of Prague that he lost out in decades earlier, 1599. He spends his time trying to manipulate that his son, Bezalel, should take over as rabbi for him, because at this point he's an older man. His patron, Mordechai Meisel, dies in 1601. In 1602, Maharal is arrested with several other rabbinic figures because of a murder that went on until they solved the murder. We don't know much about that event. Rav Yitzchak Katz, the son-in-law, edits some of the Maharal's writings that had not been published in his own lifetime. Rav Yitzchak Katz also edits the writings of the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, meaning the philosophic writings. He also edits the writings of Chaim ben Bezalel. Okay. And between Maharal's death and his republishing at the end of the 18th century, he's most famous for his discussions on Yeridea. Maharal's first published book was the Gur Aryeh on Rashi in 1578. Gvurat Hashem is 1582. 1589 is Derech Chaim on Pirkei Avot. 1595 Netzivot Olam. 1595 Netzivot Olam. You don't have to know this for exam, just so you can fit things in. And 1599 Tiferet Yisrael was published. The first two volumes came out anonymously because this was a radically new philosophy of Maharal. Gevurot and Derech. I mean, Gur Aryeh came out under his own name. Gevurot Hashem and Derech Chaim came out anonymously. But then already by Netzivot Olam, he threw it his own name because he's already fought the battles and he's respected. And with this, I will continue next class on Monday. At this point, you don't have to do anything. Just listen while I give introductions. Okay.